This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Before we get to our usual science news, I have some other really big news to share with you this week. And that is, we are adding a host. Flora Lichtman is joining me as host on Science Friday. Flora is here. So happy to have you here with me.
Hi, Ira. I am thrilled to be here with you.
Yeah, we're thrilled to have you. You know, you longtime sci-fi listeners may remember Flora. Years ago, she was our video editor, often came on the show to do the video pick of the week, like this one. Time now for our video pick of the week. Flora Lichtman, our multimedia editor, is here, and I know what you have in store, because I've looked at this video, and it's unbelievable.
I know, Ira. This is a video that I don't actually think we could oversell if we
no.
tried. This is a run, don't walk to your laptop or desktop computer video, because it's really, your mind's going to be blown. It's going to be great.
Okay, now tell us what it is that we're going to be blown.
Now that you're primed, it's about cephalopods, which are squid, octopus, and cuttlefish, and it's about how they camouflage. Yes, Where's the Octopus? A classic.
The Where's the Octopus film, if I remember it, that one is one of your most popular. I know it's been seen more than a million times, and it starts out so wonderful with the octo expert Roger Hanlon. He comes upon what looks like a rock on the ocean floor, and it just turns into something else, right?
Yes, it looks like a rock, and then it becomes very suddenly an octopus, and it's totally shocking. I remember Roger Hanlon told us that when he captured that footage, he screamed. You know, he's diving and he screamed, and people thought he was having a dive accident because it was just like he knew when he caught it. I mean, that video, I think, at Science Friday, for me, it was my magnum octopus.
Ooh, Flora, with puns like that, we're going to get along just fine.
Where do you think I learned them? So that tape, I think, was from 2011, but I actually started at Science Friday as an intern in 2005, you know, exactly 20 years ago. And Ira, I'm sure you remember, but I started as a listener, and I think this probably qualifies me for superfan status, because I remember I emailed you out of the blue to see if I could work on the show, and by some miracle, you didn't file it in your phishing folder, and instead, you gave me a shot. You gave me my first gig in journalism. So thank you for that. Not to be cheesy, but it did change my life.
Yes, I remember it well, to quote a song from My Fair Lady. So tell us about what you've been up to, right, since your time with Sci-Fi. What have you been working on?
So in a lot of ways, you know, I think Science Friday set me on my path. And my whole career really has been about making science fun and accessible and human. And one of the projects I'm really proud of is a series of short films that appeared on the New York Times that I co-directed. And they were about seminal scientific discoveries, but there's a twist. They were all animated with paper puppets that we made in our living rooms.
Love those puppets.
Yeah, I know. I mean, despite the DIY element and the fact that they were put together with glue sticks and construction paper, the project got nominated for an Emmy. In fact, we lost to Oprah, which I'm only saying because it's my crowning achievement in life.
Yeah, you share that with a lot of people. So that's very high honor,
to Oprah.
Actually. Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, the thing is, these films taught me so much about the history of science. And I know you know this too, Ira, how much resolve it takes to make and kind of stand by big discoveries, because discoveries that challenge people's assumptions about how the world works, you know, often, I don't know, maybe almost always are met with some skepticism. So let me give you an example. Ira, have you heard of Antonie von Leeuwenhoek?
I remember that was the guy with the microscope, right?
Yes, the guy with the microscope, exactly. So he was born in 1632. He was actually a haberdasher in the Netherlands, but he had this side hustle making microscopes. And they were like these little handheld single lens devices. No one really knew how he made his lenses, but they were better than anyone else's at the time. And so Leeuwenhoek saw things no one had ever seen before, you know, microorganisms that people didn't know existed. So here's a clip from that film.
Leeuwenhoek called them in Dutch dierkens. And Dierkens, that's a diminutive of the word deer.
Deer, D-I-E-R.
And which is the Dutch word for animal.
What Leeuwenhoek called them was little animals.
This was all so new. The word microorganism did not exist at the time. The word bacteria is from the 19th century.
And that strikes me as Adam in the Garden of Eden, who in Genesis named all the animals. It was just a brand new world. And he was the first person in it.
Wow, love that microbial zoo you had going there.
I know. This is like microbiome 0.001. And of course, people didn't believe Leeuwenhoek at first because it was so shocking. You know, this idea that we were surrounded by animals no one had ever seen before.
Yeah, being a pioneer can be a pretty lonely existence at times, can't it?
I think so. And that was one of the things that I picked up doing these stories. But another project that really, you know, sort of shaped my experience was working with Bill Nye.
Bill just won the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Congrats.
Yes. Congratulations, Bill, if you are listening. Have you worked with Bill?
I worked with Bill for a while on various projects. And I think one of the most famous moments on the show was when Bill came into the studio and I asked him to show us how he tied a bow tie. And somewhere we have a video of him doing that.
His bow ties are on point. He always looks dapper. So I worked with Bill as a writer on his Netflix show, Bill Nye Saves the World, which was kind of like one part geeky science demos that we know Bill Nye for and one part late night talk show. And it was extremely fun and very different from my public radio roots.
Not quite like the set you work on now, right?
A little slightly different. But Ira, I want to tell you about one more project that I'm really proud of. It's a podcast I created at Gimlet Media, and the show was called Every Little Thing, and it ran for 5 years, which I know in sci-fi years is short, but it's long in podcast years. And that show, no coincidence, shares a lot of DNA with Science Friday. You know, one of the things I've always loved about sci-fi is that this show centers listener voices. And so we did the same thing on Every Little Thing. Every episode was built around a listener's burning question. And then we found kind of the world's top experts who could answer that question. And we called the listener back and told them what we found. And you know, the questions ranged from, why do auctioneers talk like that?
$20, $25, $30, $35, $45, $45, $50, $50, $60.
To what really lives in the New York City sewers.
But then we start looking around the room and the wall is kind of moving and shimmering.
I don't know. You may not want to know the answer
pretty
to that.
Pretty brave subject, yes.
Yes, picture a dark, dank room wallpapered with cockroaches. Ooh. But you know, maybe our most famous episode was this story that honestly blew my mind, too. I learned that for all of my life, I have completely misunderstood the flamingo.
The flamingo. Of all the things in your life, it's the flamingo.
Well, I've misunderstood a lot of things, Ira, but this is one of the things I misunderstood.
I mean, but what is there to misunderstand about the flamingo? Right? You see it standing there with its legs in the water and stuff like that?
Yeah. Okay. So when I say flamingo, what adjectives come to mind?
All right. So I say, as I said, that long, scrawny legs. It's got its beak in the water. It's pink. It's kind of weird looking from another planet.
Yes. Okay. So they're a little bit goofy. They've got these gangly legs. And yes, critically, they are pink, a color that that historically has not had a lot of power. Paging Barbie, the whole subtext of that movie. But Ira, buckle up. Feathers will be ruffled.
Well, you know, I have some pretty tough feathers, so I'm waiting for this. Go for it.
Okay. So flamingos seem maybe dorky, delicate, but that is not their lane. Flamingos are tough.
It takes a tough bird, a flamingo. They're tough.
A tough bird. This is Felicity Arango from the American Museum of Natural History.
Flamingos are adapted to some pretty extreme habitats.
I think of them as tropical birds, but they can also live in these high-altitude wetlands, like 17,000 feet above sea level, where it freezes at night.
They're in these high-altitude lakes, and the flamingos can freeze inside the wetlands.
What? Their legs are actually frozen
into the ice, yep. And as the sun comes out and it begins to warm up, and eventually the ice around their legs melts, and they'll get up and they'll just walk away.
No. Who knew? Wow.
I know. It is surprising. And that's not all. So these wetlands, they're not just icy. They can also be extremely salty and even filled with toxic chemicals.
Some of the wetlands have even arsenic in them. I've also known of researchers that have had some of their skin peel off and react to these extreme chemicals.
It's caustic enough that human skin might slough off in this environment.
If you spent a lot of time there, I suppose that could happen.
So yeah, they can withstand toxic ponds. Last one, my personal favorite flam fact? Flamingos can drink boiling water. They live near these hot springs where water is near boiling temperatures, and they can guzzle it down.
And without a tea bag, I'll bet.
They're fierce. They're formidable. They are freaking tough. And I think they get underestimated. This is my theory, because they're pink. So the flamingo became a little bit of a mascot for ELT, and I hope we can keep the flamingo love flowing here at SciFry.
Well, Flora, now that you're here, I'm looking forward to keeping that love flowing. So glad you're back with us.
I'm very glad to be here, Ira. Thanks.
And you'll be hearing more from Flora later in the hour and on every hour of Science Friday going forward alongside me as SciFry's two hosts. After the break, outgoing Surgeon General Vivek Murthy joins me to talk about his time in office, what comes next, and his latest report highlighting how alcohol use increases the risk of cancer. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Most of us are very familiar with the dangers of alcohol, how risky driving under the influence is, the damage alcohol can do to the liver. But now the Surgeon General has highlighted another negative consequence of drinking alcohol, and that is cancer. In his latest report, Dr. Vivek Murthy detailed the growing body of research showing that drinking alcohol can increase the risk of certain types of cancer. He's also recommended adding a warning label to alcoholic drinks, outlining the connection between alcohol use and cancer. Dr. Murthy joins me to talk about the science that informed his latest advisory. Welcome back to Science Friday. Nice to have you.
Thanks so much, Ira. I always love being on with you.
Thank you. Nice to have you here. Dr. Murthy, what are the types of cancers we're talking about here for which alcohol is a cause?
Well, thanks, Ira. Look, alcohol is now the third leading preventable cause of cancer behind tobacco and obesity. It's responsible for 100,000 cases of cancer and 20,000 cancer deaths in the United States every year. It's now clear that alcohol is causally linked to seven types of cancer: breast cancer, colorectal cancer, mouth, throat, voice box, esophageal, and liver cancer. There may be additional cancers as well where there's a causal link, but that evidence is still developing. Now, the reason I issued this advisory on alcohol and cancer risk is it turns out that most people don't know that alcohol increases the risk for cancer. I think it's important that they know that so that they can make decisions for themselves and guide and shape their consumption of alcohol accordingly.
Well, I'm with you on that because I don't think anybody that I know knew the risks between alcohol and cancer. What is going on in the body that makes it such a risk?
Well, there are a few things that are happening. Number one, alcohol breaks down into our body into acetaldehyde, which is toxic to our cells. It damages DNA in multiple ways and increases the risk of mutations and cancer. But there are other ways that alcohol can cause cancer as well. And we lay out all four of these actually in our advisory. It can induce what's called oxidative stress on cells, which again increases the risk of cancer by damaging DNA. It can alter the levels of multiple hormones, including estrogen, which can in turn increase the risk of breast cancer. And finally, alcohol can lead to a greater absorption of other carcinogens. And so you put this all together, and what we see is a growing body of evidence, like over the years, that's linking alcohol to cancer.
Is there a minimum amount of alcohol that you can drink safely?
So that's a really good question. And it's something that I've thought about a lot as a doctor, because you have to advise patients on what they should do. And right, in generally with health behaviors, we tend to think about things not as zero risk, but as low risk versus higher risk. And what the data tells us fairly clearly is that more alcohol consumption is associated with more risk. So less consumption is associated with less risk. I wish there was a magic number that we could tell people at which they could drink and have zero risk altogether. But clearly, if you are drinking, let's say, occasionally or once or twice a week, your risk of cancer is going to be significantly less than if you are drinking on a daily basis.
Should the guidelines then be changed about what we tell people?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because the current dietary guidelines set the limits on alcohol consumption at one drink a day for women and two drinks a day for men. But what we found in our analysis of the data is that the risk of cancer increases even within those guideline limits. So one of the recommendations I have called for in this advisory is for those limits to be reassessed and to include and incorporate the cancer risk. And my belief is that those levels should, in fact, be lower if we truly want to reduce people's risk of cancer.
Do you really think people are going to stop drinking? I mean, we had prohibition, things like that. I mean, this must be a really tough sell, I would think.
Well, it's interesting you say that, Ira, because I've been surprised by the variety of responses that we've gotten. First of all, not telling everyone that they should completely stop drinking and that there's never an occasion at which you can have a drink. What we are doing is asking people to re-examine their practices and behaviors with alcohol, and particularly the amount that they consume, because most people were led to believe that alcohol is an unmitigated positive thing for your health, and you should drink and it'll help you live longer.
We were told a glass of wine a day was good for you.
That's right. And it turns out that that story is actually a lot more complicated as more and more data has emerged showing that the impact on our heart is actually more complicated. There are certain types of illness when it comes to the heart, which are made worse by alcohol. We know the risk of abnormal heart rhythms like atrial fibrillation goes up with drinking, as do high blood pressure and the risk of heart failure. There is a chance that there may be a positive benefit when it comes to heart attacks from drinking at certain levels, but exactly what that level is and how much benefit one gets is uncertain. So the overall impact on your heart is unclear. What is clear is that there is a causal link between alcohol and cancer. And I think if people know that, then especially if they have a personal history of cancer or if they're at increased risk because of their genetics or family history, they may choose to make decisions differently and perhaps reduce how much they drink.
Mm-hmm. So if you quit drinking today, and I'm thinking about like smoking, you know, would that decrease your risk of developing cancer if you've been a moderate drinker for, let's say, 20 years?
Yeah, so we don't have enough data to be able to tell you with certainty how your risk will decrease over what period of time. You know, with smoking, we generally have much better data to help us understand that. But I think given the data we have, my advice to people would be that if you are drinking at a level, you know, like let's say on a daily basis, and you want to reduce your risk, that reducing that, like going down even to a couple of times a week from daily, is likely going to reduce your risk for the longer term. Whether that benefit manifests in a month, in a year, in 2 years, we need data to tell us. But the data is right now telling us that less drinking means less risk of cancer.
You're also recommending adding a warning label. Congress would need to approve that, right? Does that stand any chance in the upcoming Congress?
So a warning label would need to be approved by Congress. And one of the things that I'm encouraged by is that cancer prevention has largely been a bipartisan issue that has enjoyed broad support, and for good reason, because many of us know people who have cancer. Cancer devastates individuals and families, as I've seen firsthand as a doctor caring for people with cancer over the years. In the past, when we have come out with recommendations for labels or reports that highlight health concerns, in the past, we have seen Congress act. Going back to 1964, when the Surgeon General's office issued the first report on tobacco, linking smoking to cancer, the very next year, Congress passed legislation that put a warning label on boxes of cigarettes. So we have a warning label right now already on alcohol containers. They speak to the risk of drinking during pregnancy and drinking while operating cars or heavy machinery. But we now need to update them to include cancer risk. Mm-hmm.
This week, you released your, quote, parting prescription to America, in which you focus on the importance of community. Please tell me about that.
Well, this is deeply meaningful to me, Ira, because over the last two terms that I've had the privilege of serving, there has been a question that has been on my mind and that I've struggled to figure out. And that has been, what is the deeper root cause of the unhappiness and pain that I see so often in communities across America? So often this is a pain that's not easily explained. It's not always solely due to economic hardship or concerns about safety or the negative headlines people are reading. Often there's something deeper. And after many conversations, digging into the research in this area, talking to experts from a variety of disciplines, what I've come to understand is there are three critical elements that we need in our life to be fulfilled that have been eroding over time. And those are relationships, purpose, and service. And in this parting prescription, what I called for is us to re-anchor our lives around what I call the triad of fulfillment: relationships, purpose, and service. Right now, Ira, the challenge we have is that society has been moving more and more in the direction of a different triad, the triad of success, which, as young people tell me all the time, is anchored in money, fame, and power. And there's nothing wrong with pursuing any of those three, but the challenge is when we come to assume that that's the path to fulfillment, when we assume that that's going to make us happy in a sustained way. And the reality is it just doesn't. So this parting prescription is fundamentally about shifting the balance in our lives towards relationships, purpose, and service. And when we do that, what we find is that we can build lives where we feel a sense of belonging and have a strong sense of community.
Yes, we've seen this over your career, talking about depression, talking about loneliness, which are all part, I think, of what you're talking about. And we have a very fractured community as a country. Do you think that we can live up to those ideals that you're talking about?
I think we can, and I think we must, because what's at stake is nothing less than our fulfillment, our health, our happiness, and the well-being of our children. You know, people across the country and really across the world are struggling with how to navigate the extraordinarily complex world that we're living in, and to figure out how to create the health, happiness, and fulfillment that we want for ourselves and for our children. And they're working really hard at it. I don't think people are unhappy because somehow they're lazy and not putting in the work. I think people are working harder than ever. But as the world has grown more complex and changed so rapidly, I worry that we've lost hold of some of these foundational elements that used to support our life and used to help us make it through difficult times, all kinds of adversity, and still find a reason to be happy and to be fulfilled. And I think fundamentally, at a very deep level, we all want relationships in our life. We want to live with a sense of purpose. Our instinct is to help other people, like when we see somebody in need. So I see the call to rebuild our lives on relationships, purpose, and service, not so much as a call to transform ourselves into something we're not, but as a return to who we fundamentally are. And this is something that I think we can do. I've been really overwhelmed by the response we've gotten to this prescription from people across the political spectrum, across the country, who have said, this is what we need. This is what has been missing in our lives. And my hope and the work I want to keep doing after I'm Surgeon General is to help rebuild that sense of community, to re-anchor our world in the relationships, purpose, and service that will bring us fulfillment.
Let's talk about what's next for you. How would you continue this campaign?
It's a good question. Well, I think there's a lot more that needs to be done to bring this message to more corners of our country and to, frankly, also bring the rest of the world into this conversation as well. Many countries are struggling with the same drivers of unhappiness and pain that we are. And so that communications piece is going to be important. But I also find myself wanting to create experiences for people where they can actually see and feel what it's like to be a part of community, even if it's for a brief period of time, where they can recognize what a powerful impact it can have on their life. So I'm thinking about how to do this next, but I'll tell you what's at the center of my mind and my heart as I contemplate the future are my children. My kids are 6 and 8 years old, and I, like many parents, look at the world around them and think, gosh, we have to do something better to address the polarization and the pain and the division that we have so that we can have a more hospitable, nurturing world for our kids. And that's why I believe this work is so important. You know, I want my kids to live the American dream in the way that I was able to and my parents were able to. But the American dream, you know, when Thomas Jefferson wrote about the pursuit of happiness as an inalienable right in the Declaration of Independence, he wasn't talking about achievement and wealth and fame and focusing more and more on ourselves. To Jefferson, the pursuit of happiness was a virtuous pursuit that involved serving others and contributing to something greater than yourself.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that public service is still in your future?
I don't know.
Maybe politics?
Well, look, I want to serve in the best way I can to make sure that we rebuild community in America, and I'm open to how that happens. But for right now, I think my time in public service has in government service has come to an end, but I still look at my calling as very much to serve the public. And I will do that, you know, in my next phase as a private citizen. But to me, this is the work that really matters. It's a work that gives meaning to my life. And if we can rebuild a society that's anchored in relationships, purpose, and service, then there's a really good shot that my kids and all of our children will be able to inherit a world that's kinder, that's more generous, and ultimately more harmonious than what we're experiencing right now.
Is that what you would like your legacy to reflect, your efforts to do that?
Well, I think history determines what our legacies are. What I want is to be able to look in the mirror every morning when I wake up and feel a sense of purpose and to know that I'm getting up to work on things that are going to make the world better for my kids. And I say this because there were many times caring for patients in Boston during the earlier part of my career where I would see challenges that they were facing that were rooted in the social fabric of our country, which was fraying. I would recognize that, yeah, I could diagnose an illness and make the right prescriptions for them in terms of medications. But if they didn't have a family to support them, if they didn't know their neighbors, if they lived in an unsafe neighborhood, if people didn't care about the policies that my patients needed because they didn't affect other people. Like if we didn't feel like we were connected to each other and invested in each other, it was really hard to address the deeper root causes of so much what I was seeing as a doctor in the hospital. And so, yeah, this is what matters to me right now. I want to address these deeper root causes. I want us to be a country that can care deeply about each other and courageously support each other and sacrifice for each other. And I think we can do that because I think it's in our DNA. I think it's who we are.
Mm-hmm. Any advice you'd like to give the next Surgeon General?
Well, one of the most important things I learned as Surgeon General is what I learned as a doctor, which is that you can have your own ideas about what issues you want to take on, but spend as much time as you can listening to people and asking them what they need, what issues are on their mind, and then craft your agenda based on that. It was a listening tour that I did my very first term as Surgeon General that fundamentally changed my agenda and that taught me the second time around to go out there, to listen to people, and to let their stories and their experiences shape the issues you choose to take on.
Well, Dr. Murthy, I want to thank you for your public service and for all you've done and bringing your message to us. And I hope you'll stay in touch wherever you go and whatever you do. Check in with us every now and then.
Well, thank you so much, Ira. It has been the honor of my life to serve as Surgeon General. And I am just so grateful for the chance to serve the country that I love and the chance to be a part of something that will always be meaningful to me and close to my heart. So I'm grateful to you.
You're welcome. Dr. Vivek Murthy, U.S. Surgeon General based in Washington, D.C., Something tells me we will be hearing a lot from him sometime in the future. We have to take a break, and when we come back, a roundup of the top science news of the week, including an update on California's wildfires. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. As we've all been watching, Los Angeles County has been battered by devastating wildfires. Tens of thousands of acres have burned and thousands of people have been forced to flee their homes. So why are these fires raging like this and burning down homes, some of them not even in forests? It has to do with the wind. Joining me to tell us about this and other science news of the week is Umair Irfan, senior correspondent at Vox, covering science, climate change, and the environment. He's based in Washington, D.C. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Hey, Ira. Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. Okay, let's get into these California fires. I talked about the wind. What factors are coming to make this place so ripe for fires right now?
Right. These winds are actually a seasonal phenomenon. They're typically called the Santa Ana winds. And usually in the wintertime, they start to pick up. They blow from the northeast towards the southwest, towards Los Angeles. And this they occur basically when you have this air over the mountains start to roll downhill. And as they build up pressure, the air dries out, it speeds up, and they start gusting towards cities like Los Angeles. This year, though, they've been exceptionally strong with gusts reaching up to 100 miles an hour. And that's part in because of this high pressure system that has kind of parked over the mountains that is helping squeeze more air outward and westward towards the city. And that's adding this additional gust. You know, meteorologists were able to actually see this coming. They've been warning about very, very high winds this year since the beginning of the year. And then on top of that, you know, Los Angeles, the area, saw an exceptionally dry start to its winter, which meant that a lot of the vegetation around it, which is mainly grasslands and chaparral with a few trees here and there, it dried out very quickly. And the key thing to note is that while this winter was very dry, the prior winter was very, very wet. And so over the past year, basically through most of 2024, there was this bumper crop of grasses and fast growing shrubs that built up. It dried out in the record heat. And now in this dry winter and the combination of high winds has created basically the ideal conditions for a major fire.
Wow. You know, we're keeping all of you out in Southern California in our hearts. But for those of us on the other side of the country, many of us are dealing with an extreme cold snap. Give us the lowdown on that winter air.
Right. And there's this interconnection between both the fires and the cold snap across much of the country as well. And that is this phenomenon called the jet stream. This is a high altitude, fast moving band of air. It normally circles the Arctic in sort of an even circle, but every now and then, as it weakens, it starts to sort of meander and snake across parts of the Northern Hemisphere. So as it pushes down in some areas, like it's doing over the eastern United States, it lets cold Arctic air start to spill over and help fuel these bouts of extreme cold. And then in other parts of the country, it starts to move upward and allows warm air to sort of hold in place. And that's kind of what we're seeing across the west of the U.S. And so that's kind of the interconnection here. And so on the East Coast, yes, we're seeing this burst of cold air. And scientists expect that potentially, if the Arctic continues to warm, it can cause these kinds of destabilization events to happen more often.
That may seem strange in people's minds. You know, it's getting warmer, but we're getting these polar vortexes.
Right. I mean, the key thing to remember is that the Arctic is warming about four times faster than the rest of the planet. And so a tiny bit of warming on the rest of the planet usually means a lot more warming there. And warm, quote unquote, air in the Arctic is still frigid by our standards. So even warmish Arctic air, when it spills down, can induce a lot of ice and snow when it reaches the lower 48.
All right, let's move on to some virus news. And actually, unbelievably, some good news. There's a viral outbreak in China that's actually not as bad as many experts feared. Tell us about this.
Right. There was some news going around that there was this spike in this respiratory infection caused by this virus called the human metapneumovirus, or HMPV. And there was some information and misinformation and some viral reports that there was another outbreak that was happening in China of another respiratory virus that was raising a bunch of alarm. But this week, health officials at the Chinese Centers for Disease Control and the World Health Organization, they analyzed the data and they said that basically what we're looking at is an ordinary seasonal uptick in respiratory viruses in China. Now, the HMPV cases are making up a larger share of these respiratory infections, but the overall rate of infections is basically what they would expect for this time of year, that essentially as more people gather indoors in the winter, colds and other kinds of infections will spread more readily. And that's kind of what we're seeing happening right now. And this virus itself tends to cause fairly mild cold-like symptoms, so it's not severe even if you get it.
Okay, it's good that we can breathe a sigh of relief about this virus, because this is the virus season. And unfortunately, there's some not great news about another virus, the norovirus. Tell us about that one.
Right. The Centers for Disease Control reported this week that actually the norovirus levels in the U.S. are unusually high right now, probably at the highest levels they've seen in more than a decade. In the real world, the numbers might be even higher because this is just based on cases that have been reported or have interacted with the medical system. You know, the norovirus is a stomach bug. It causes, you know, gastrointestinal problems. It causes, you know, vomiting and diarrhea and a lot of other unpleasantness. And we do see it tend to rise more in the winter. But part of the reason we're seeing an unusual spike right now is maybe some of the consequences of the COVID-19 pandemic. Basically, immunity to norovirus usually lasts a couple years. But during COVID-19, when people were isolating, there was much less transmission of norovirus. And so a lot of that natural immunity that had built up for a while had died down. And then as people started gathering once again, that disease has now come roaring back.
And how do you protect yourself from this miserable virus?
Well, again, the basic measures that we all know and love. I mean, you know, washing your hands appropriately. You know, this is something that can be transmitted through your hands and through contact with people who are infected. And then also, you know, maintain good hygiene, distancing, and some wearing masks if you're not feeling well, and wearing masks around people who are likely to be infectious.
Right. All right. Let's move on to a bit of political news. As we know, we're going to have a change in presidents this month, but President Biden at the 11th hour has banned new oil and gas drilling along most of the U.S. coasts in a way that would be hard for President Trump to reverse. Tell me about that.
Right. Basically, they issued this new ban on drilling in coastal waters across basically 625 million acres. This includes pretty much the entire East Coast and the West Coast, as well as parts of the Gulf of Mexico and parts of Alaska. These are areas where we don't see much drilling to begin with, and we haven't seen much oil and gas industry interest. But this designation also basically kind of closes the door to that essentially sends a signal to the industry that this is going to be something that's going to be off limits for the foreseeable future. The White House also said that they're going to maintain federal protections for 2,000 grizzly bears in the Rocky Mountains. The population of these bears has recovered pretty extensively over the past few decades, and their range is expanding, but it's also leading to more conflicts with locals. And so they've been seeking approval to hunt and to contain these bears, but these federal protections mean that they're going to be off limits for the foreseeable future. And in addition to that, you know, President Biden this week also announced new monument designations in California, protecting about 800,000 acres of new land, and for similar reasons, to protect them against, you know, new oil and gas development, and trying to use legal mechanisms that they hope won't be easily overturned by the next administration, although President-elect Trump has already said that he wants to reverse a lot of these protections.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's talk about another story that's been in the news this week. There's been a review of 74 medical studies that links higher fluoride exposure to lower IQ in kids, but it might not be as straightforward as that. What does this survey say, and why are people pushing back on it?
Well, the authors of this study that was published this week in JAMA Pediatrics note themselves that basically the main conclusion of this study, of this review, is that the data out there just isn't very good. They looked at 74 medical studies, as you noted, looking at these links between lower IQ in children, and basically found that the quality of the research isn't very good. All of the research is based on studies that were conducted outside of the United States, most of them in China, and they were conducted in communities that have much higher levels of fluoride exposure than you would find in the United States, and the quality of those studies are not very good. And so while they did show a link when you pull them all together, they did issue this major caveat that essentially this is not a very robust finding, and that if you wanted to make any kind of statement about this, you really need to do a lot more research.
Right. All right. Let's lighten up a little bit at the end here with a topic that we all love, dinosaurs. A new dinosaur? What's going on here?
Well, right. Researchers this week at the University of Wisconsin-Madison described these fossils that kind of upend the timeline of when they think dinosaurs originated. Basically, you know, millions of years ago, most of the continents were pushed together in this giant supercontinent called Pangaea. And the prevailing theory was that essentially dinosaurs originated in the southern part of the continent and millions of years ahead before they started moving and migrating further and further north. But these new fossils, they were found in essentially an area that was in the northern hemisphere of the supercontinent around the same time, basically around 230 million years old. And that indicates that essentially the dinosaurs have been roaming much further and more widely earlier than they had expected. And this dinosaur, it's about the size of a chicken with a long tail. The name of it is Avetum Banduviche. It's from the name drawn from the Shoshone language, which means long ago dinosaur. But basically, this finding kind of really forces them to reevaluate exactly when dinosaurs originated. And perhaps they may have started, you know, spreading across the earth even earlier than we realized.
Wow. Wow. Love our dino news, Umair. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Umair Irfan, senior correspondent at Vox, covering science, climate change, and the environment. He's based in Washington, D.C.
And to close the hour, as you know, we strive to bring you the most important science news stories of the week, the stories you absolutely must be looped in on. And there's one more we just couldn't drop. A new paper that clears up a long-standing mystery about the hula hoop. Specifically, why doesn't it fall down? Researchers at NYU looked into the head-spinning physics and math of hooping, and as a bonus, they investigated what body types make for the best hoopers. I'm not going to leave you hanging. Here to tell us more is my next guest, Olivia Pomerank. She's a PhD candidate in mathematics at New York University and an author on this new paper. Welcome to Science Friday, Olivia.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Why hula hoops?
So there's actually evidence of hula hooping in the human historical record as far back as 500 BCE. It shows up for the first time in ancient Greece.
Wow.
Yeah. So it shows up kind of again and again throughout history, independently in a myriad of different cultures. It's used as a form of recreation, religious ceremony, even exercise. And even today, artists and performers can do some really impressive stuff with hula hoops. And so we were actually just kind of inspired by just sort of seeing performers in Washington Square Park right outside NYU. And we figured, oh, hula hoops must have been sort of studied to death at this point.
That was your assumption?
Yeah, that was the assumption, because it's been around for, you know, millennia. But it actually hasn't been. We dug into the literature, just kind of driven by curiosity. And we found that hula hooping wasn't, even understood at a basic physics level. And so previous studies have sort of looked at the problem sort of from a top-down view, like in two dimensions, and studied the kind of twirling dynamics, but nobody's answered the really obvious kind of glaring question, which is, how does the hoop even stay up? And that's the question that we kind of set out to answer.
That does seem like the fundamental mystery of hula hooping. Why doesn't it fall?
Exactly.
Okay, tell me how you figured it out. I hear there are robots involved.
Yes, there are robots involved. So it seems like all of the forces kind of exerted during hula hooping should be directed horizontally, right? It's not immediately clear what's counteracting the gravitational force that's pointing down. So what's keeping it up? And so we sort of guessed that the shape of the body executing the hula hooping may be important. And so we 3D printed a bunch of different body types in order to test, maybe about the size of your hand.
Okay.
And we made a cylinder, a cone, so pointy part facing upwards. And then we also made basically an hourglass-shaped body. And so we basically gyrated each of these. So that means translating in a circle without rotating it, drove that robotically, and just by hand tossed plastic hoops around each of the bodies.
Tiny little baby hula hoops.
Tiny little baby hula hoops, exactly. So it's definitely a funny looking experimental setup.
Okay, so it seems like there's two questions. There's like, what's the best body shape to keep a hula hoop spinning? That's one. And what is the answer?
So the answer is basically that you need to have sort of a sufficiently sloped and sufficiently curved body. So translating that to humans basically means that you need kind of hips, which provide slope, as well as a waist, which provides curvature. And there's sort of a sweet spot in there where the hula hoop will sort of naturally want to sit just below kind of the narrowest part of your waist. Then the hoop is sort of resting almost on like a tiny little sort of surface.
A ledge, your hip ledge.
Exactly. And so there's a tiny little force pointing upwards if you have slope.
So that's it. That's what's counteracting gravity, your hips.
Exactly. Exactly. Your hips. And then the reason you also need a waist and hips aren't enough is that it's not enough to just counteract gravity. You also need the hoop to be sort of trapped in place. And so if you have a waist and you have sort of a curved profile, then you actually get the hoop to be trapped in place. So if it goes up a tiny bit, it'll be pushed down. And if it goes down a tiny bit, it'll be pushed up.
I love that there's a physics answer to this. When you defend your dissertation, will you be hula hooping the whole time?
There is a chance that I bring one along as a prop. Not the whole time. Definitely not the whole time. I don't know if I have the hula hoops prowess necessarily to do that.
Olivia, thank you so much for closing the loop on this mystery.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's always fun to talk about this kind of stuff.
Olivia Pomerank is a PhD candidate in mathematics at New York University. And one last request before we go. Polar vortexes, Arctic blasts, short, dark days. We are in the winter doldrums. And if you're like me, your only coping mechanism is not Surgeon General approved. So we are doing a show on how to do winter better. And I want to hear from you. What creative coping mechanisms get you through the winter? Maybe you embrace the cold and you start every day with a polar plunge. Or maybe you protest winter and you're that person who wears cargo shorts no matter the weather. Tell us your best, most unique wintertime survival strategies. We want to hear from you. Leave us a message at 646-767-6532. Get your pencils out, 646-767-6532, or send a voice memo to scifry@sciencefriday.com.
Lots of folks helped make this show happen this week, including
Rasha Aridi,
Sandy Roberts,
Shoshana Buxbaum,
Danielle Johnson.
Thank you, everybody. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. If you missed any part of the program or you would like to hear it again, subscribe to our podcasts or ask your smart speaker to play Science Friday. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow.
And I'm Flora Lichtman. Happy Friday, and thanks for listening.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. In case you missed the news, I'm welcoming Flora Lichtman on board as a host. Yes, we'll be working side by side to continue bringing you the fun, the thought-provoking, and even the weird science stories.
Thank you, Ira. Yes, excited to bring the weird and excited to be here. Later in the hour, what you need to know about the bird flu outbreak. The U.S. just reported its first death from the virus. How worried should we be? And artificial general intelligence. We're going to parse the hype. Should we be preparing for our AI overlords? But first, the latest on NASA's Mars sample return mission. That's the ambitious project that aims to use the Perseverance rover to collect Martian rocks and sand and even gulps of Martian air, and then through a complicated handoff between different spacecraft, return those Martian samples back to Earth. In 2023, a review board said that the original plan to bring the samples back home would be much more expensive and take much longer than originally planned. So this week, NASA announced two options on how to cut costs and bring the samples back to Earth by the late 2030s. But the agency did not commit to a plan, leaving it to the next administration to sort out. So is the mission on the rocks? Joining me now to get us up to speed is my guest, Dr. Jim Bell, professor of Earth and Space Exploration at Arizona State University, based in Tempe, Arizona, and distinguished visiting scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Dr. Bell, welcome back to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me on, Flora.
Okay, Jim, so what do you make of this announcement of these two possible plans with no commitment to either? Is this a good sign for the future of the mission, a bad sign, neutral? What's your take?
Well, the good news is that NASA is supportive of doing this mission, continuing to try to find ways to bring these spectacular samples that the Perseverance rover is collecting back to the Earth. This has been the highest priority that's been identified by the National Academy of Sciences and the planetary science community for this next decade. The frustrating part is, as you said, you know, it's been a couple of years now that we've been trying to figure out how to get this mission on the books.
Yeah, so why has it taken this long to even just get some possible Plan Bs?
Yeah, I think the reason is it will be the most complicated robotic mission that NASA or any space agency has ever attempted. It's a hard thing to do. And there are pieces of what need to be done, the big lander to go back to Mars, a rocket to launch the samples off the surface, an orbiter to rendezvous with those samples in Mars orbit, bring the samples back. The pieces exist from past missions, but putting those pieces together, as you alluded to earlier, is incredibly complex.
Yes.
And hard things take time and hard things take a lot of money.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it reminds me of like a relay in the Olympics or something. Like you have to pass this baton to all these different spacecraft, robot to spacecraft. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, or that game Mousetrap. I don't know if you ever played that as a kid, where you get all these different parts, you know, and this part has to integrate with that part and hand over to that part, and the ball has to keep moving forward. In this case, the ball is a collection of at least 30 amazing samples, very carefully selected by the Perseverance rover team on Mars.
Yeah, I want to talk about that. So, you know, this mission has two parts. Part one is collect the samples. Part two is send them back to Earth. So your team is working on part one, working with the Perseverance rover to collect the samples. What are you looking for? Like, what makes a good sample?
Yeah, that's a great question. And we've thought a lot about that and started thinking about that, you know, a decade ago when the mission was sort of dreamed up and thinking about where to send it. You know, think about where would you go on the Earth to collect samples, to learn about the early history of life on Earth and the environment of the planet as a whole. And it's a tough problem. And there are, you know, dozens and dozens of places that were proposed. And ultimately, we chose a place that, you know, was by Earth standards, we thought would be considered habitable a long time ago on Mars. An ancient delta, an ancient crater lake, a place where there was water ponding and flowing on the surface, where there were sedimentary rocks preserving anything that was flowing down into that lake. And, you know, on Earth, deltas like the Mississippi River Delta, those are amazing places to preserve evidence of biology and life. And maybe that's true on Mars, we thought. And so we've been trying to sample sedimentary rocks, mudstones, sandstones, delta deposits, the soil itself, and the basic kinds of chemistry and mineralogy in the rocks, the volcanic rocks, really try to get a snapshot of an ancient environment that may preserve evidence of past life or past habitability on Mars. And also will tell us lots, we believe, about Mars just as a planet itself.
So Perseverance has already collected the samples, is what I'm gathering.
Many of them, not all of them, but we've got more than 20 now collected.
Do people fight for it, or they're like, "No, I want this delta," and someone's like, "No, I want this mudstone"?
Fight, yes, in a collegial way. We're all on the same team, so you know, there's lots of heated discussions about, you know, do we sample here? Do we drill there? Do we drive left? Do we drive right? But in the end, we're all working towards the same goal.
So where are they stored? Is there like a little hidey hole somewhere on Mars? Is there a shoebox in the rover? Yes. Where do you put them?
There's two places that they're stored. The main place is inside the rover, inside the front of the belly of the rover. There's a tray and an entire collection of sample tubes. And a little tiny robotic arm, I think about it like a little tiny Tyrannosaurus Rex arm inside the rover that moves those sample tubes around. They can pick them up and deliver them to the drill and the coring system, and then collect them from the coring system and put them back into the tray and seal them hermetically. So most of the samples are stored in that tray, but 10 of the samples have already been dropped onto the surface. And so as a contingency, as a just in case, the rover doesn't survive long enough to transfer the samples to this Mars sample return lander. In case that doesn't happen, there are 10 of them out in a very flat parking lot kind of place in the crater that we're at, just spread out across the surface, and a future mission could go pick those 10 up if we can't get the primary samples out of the rover itself.
Sample takeout. They're just waiting for them to be picked up.
That's a great way to think of it, yes. Yeah.
Okay, so NASA had this press conference talking about how to possibly get these samples back. Can you just give me a high-level overview of the options?
So, as you mentioned earlier, the plan of record, it just has proven untenable in terms of schedule because the samples wouldn't come back until sometime in the 2040s. And in terms of cost, because some estimates of cost had it over $10, $11 billion. So the plans put forward are a combination of try to trim the size of some of the components, lower the costs, use more what NASA calls heritage components, pieces that have flown into space before, like the SkyCrane system that landed the Curiosity and Perseverance rovers on Mars. NASA engineers and others were able to sharpen their pencils and reduce the the size of this rocket that needs to take the samples off of Mars and lower the mass and get it into the sort of realm of being able to use the sky crane and other kinds of equipment. So that lowers cost. And the other part of it is bringing in more involvement of commercial space, companies like SpaceX or Intuitive Machines, Firefly. So there's a big commercial space industry out there that is eager to get involved in NASA science missions. And while I don't know all the details, I know a lot of us are looking forward to seeing what parts of the commercial space world NASA can bring in to help solve this problem.
Best case scenario, when do you think we might see these samples back on Earth?
Best case scenario for me is like the second half of the 2030s, hopefully before 2040.
Are there people who are like, I will not retire until these samples come back?
Yes, sign me up. Yes.
Is that you? Are you that person, Jim?
I'm among them. Yes, I absolutely want to see. I'd love to see the dust on Mars with my own eyes and studying it with telescopes and spacecraft for decades. But, you know, more importantly, there's a lot of amazing lab equipment and skill here on Earth that has been working on lunar samples and meteorite samples and asteroid samples, ready to get samples from Mars and uncover those secrets. And so the sooner we get those samples into amazing laboratories around the world, the better.
So imagine these samples have just arrived in the lab. You're unboxing them. What would that moment feel like for you?
Oh, Christmas morning. Right? I mean, one of the realities of being involved in space exploration is it takes a lot of time. It takes years, decades sometimes of your professional career to realize these kinds of missions and their success. In the case of bringing back samples from Mars, it's been something that hundreds and hundreds of people have been working to try to make happen literally for decades.
Because this is the way that we would figure out whether there was life on Mars, right? Like, this is the way.
Yeah, you know, I mean, unless something just gets up and walks in front of our cameras, you're absolutely right. We don't actually have any evidence of anything like that happening, and we don't expect it because life on Mars appears to, if there was life on Mars, it probably existed very early in the history of the planet. And we know from our own planet that the early history of life on Earth was very simple, single-celled, multicellular colonies of organisms, soft-bodied, no fossils, and the traces of that early life on the Earth, on our own planet, are incredibly difficult to find and study. And our expectation is that's going to be true on Mars. And so the best that we can do is go to a place that has the best odds of preserving that subtle evidence, and then get those samples into the same kind of laboratories, the cutting-edge laboratories on the Earth that study that subtle evidence for early life on our own planet.
That's just about all the time we have. I'd like to thank my guest, Dr. Jim Bell, Professor of Earth and Space Exploration at Arizona State University, based in Tempe, Arizona, and distinguished visiting scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Thank you, Jim.
Thanks, Flora. It's been a lot of fun.
Craving more time in space? Have you ever wondered what astronaut life is really like? Next week on January 14th, Science Friday is connecting live with astronauts aboard the International Space Station. They're going to answer questions from kids across the country, and you can join too. Just visit sciencefriday.com/downlink for all the details and to RSVP. We have to take a quick break, and when we come back, the latest on bird flu. How worried should you actually be? This is Science Friday. I'm Flora Lichtman. This month, the U.S. reported its first death from bird flu, a patient in Louisiana. Back in November, a teenager in Canada was hospitalized and in intensive care with the virus. And last year, more than 60 people were diagnosed with the virus in the U.S., according to the CDC. That's up from just one case in 2022. Now, just to add a little context, H5N1 avian influenza has been circulating globally in birds and even some mammals for many years. But alarm bells went off when the virus turned up in dairy cattle last year. And since then, over 900 herds have been affected, according to the CDC. So I'm sure many of us are having COVID flashbacks. I know I am. But is that the right way to think about this? How alarmed should we be? What steps should we be taking? Here to tell us more are two influenza experts who have been following the situation closely. Let me introduce my guests. Dr. Seema Lakdawala is co-director for the Center for Transmission of Airborne Pathogens and associate professor studying influenza viruses at Emory University in Atlanta. Dr. Richard Webby is the director of the WHO Collaborating Center for Studies on the Ecology of Influenza in Animals and Birds, and a virologist at St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee. Seema, Richard, welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having us.
So this question is for both of you. Just top level, how alarmed are you? Where are you both on the pandemic alarm bell scale? Seema, let's start with you.
On the pandemic risk portion of this, I'm at a moderate level. So moderate risk of it becoming a pandemic right now, in that where it is in its current form. But in my own aspect of where I am, I'm on high alert, the possibility of a pandemic, more so than I think I've been in the past.
Okay. Richard, what about you?
Yeah, it's a tough one, but I think I'm somewhere similar to Seema. I'm not on the sort of pack my bags, ready to head to the hills stage. But my sense of unease has increased a little bit over the past 6 weeks or so from where we were before, just with what this virus has been doing and some of the things we've been seeing.
Well, I want to get into this. I mean, we've been tracking H5N1 bird flu for decades. What's happened recently that is making you concerned?
So we know some of the changes this H5 bird flu virus has to make to switch from being what is essentially is a bird virus to being a human virus. And I was a little bit reassured, I guess, prior to the beginning of the holiday season that, we really hadn't seen much evidence that the virus was making those changes that were required for that host switch. But then, investigators showed that we're one mutation away potentially from a virus that bound better to the human cell than the avian cell. Before that, I probably would have put money on it being two or three changes. So that information and then the sequencing of the virus from the case both in Canada and Louisiana suggested that the virus was making some changes in some of these areas of the genome that we know were important for this receptor switch as well.
We are seeing that already. And were we seeing those in the wild strains or were they happening within the body of these patients?
We can't answer that with 100% certainty, but I think most of the evidence suggests that these were mutations that were actually made during replication in the people.
Seema, what about you? Do you feel the same as Richard, that sort of the last 6 weeks have raised new alarms?
Definitely the last 6 weeks. And I would say actually maybe starting in September, October, I've increased my alarm. And it's not necessarily for the same reasons Richard said, some are similar. Really, for me, it's the lack of a very strong response. You know, we've known about this outbreak in cattle has been there since April. We're 10 months in and we don't know the full extent of the outbreak. And the lack of, having a really strong plan in place, having seen a lot of traction from a response perspective, increases my concern because now we're in flu season. Now we're in the time of year where we know influenza viruses transmit more efficiently between people. Like Richard, I also agree that the, you know, cases in Canada and in Louisiana are concerning. I'm less concerned about the switch in receptor preference because it's something we expect to happen every single time the virus is in a human. It has the potential to adapt, and it's constantly adapting.
You know, this virus has been showing up in sea lions and foxes and cats and cattle. Are the strains circulating in these different groups of animals the same? Are they different?
You can think they're all H5 viruses, they're all H5N1 viruses, but they're all different sort of combination of other gene segments. So no, they're not the same virus, and they probably have different properties, but we're I think just starting to try and understand that.
Well, that was my question. Are the strains equally likely to infect humans now? And are they, you know, do people have the same response to the different strains?
I think probably if you ask 10 influenza virologists, you'll get 6 different answers on that one. The truth is, no, probably they're not the same. But, you know, it's something we need to do a better job of is understanding what happens with different combinations of genes.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with Richard. You know, you're going to get lots of different opinions on this because we don't have really great experimental data on it. What we do know, though, is that the cases from individuals who have worked in dairy parlors have been more mild in their presentation. And so the Louisiana case and the Canada case that tended to be more severe, obviously the Louisiana case was fatal, is a different part of the family tree than the cattle virus.
Are those cases thought to come from birds?
Yes. So the Louisiana case and the British Columbia case are thought to be interactions with, I believe, migratory birds, so wild birds. That, I think, is really interesting for researchers like me and Richard, where we want to understand, you know, what's driving those differences in the presentation.
Well, this maybe gets to my next question. I mean, if we look at global infections in humans of bird flu over the last 2 decades or so, historically, it's been quite severe, like nearly half of the 900 reported cases in people resulted in death. But of the dozens of people who've been infected in the U.S. last year that we know of anyway, you know, most cases seem pretty mild. So what's up with that? What's going on there?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is probably due to a variety of factors. One is, you know, something that my lab has been studying is pre-existing immunity, in that some level of immunity that we've acquired in the more recent decades perhaps is providing some level of cross protection to reduce the severity of disease. Again, not against protecting against infection. It could also be, of course, the route of inoculation that these individuals were exposed to, that the dose in which they inhaled or where it splattered on their eyes. We're talking about mostly dairy workers here or the poultry workers, or it could be something about the virus itself. The other aspect could be that in the past, we've missed other infections that were more mild, and we're just capturing the ones that were more severe.
Richard, we talked to you in the summer of 2023, so, you know, a year and a half ago now, and you told us that as a human, it's very difficult to catch this virus. Is that still true?
Yeah, no, I think it is. Yeah, particularly let's think about even what's going on in the dairy cattle right now. You know, we know there's a ridiculous amount of virus in the milk of an infected cow. So the workers in these milking parlors are getting, you know, exposed to a lot of virus. And yes, we're probably missing a good percentage of those, but, you know, this is a virus that still would prefer to be replicating inside a bird than certainly a human.
Richard, you said that cows are carrying a lot of the virus. How much is a lot?
So if you think of a 10 with 8 or 9 zeros after it, that's how much per mil of milk out of these cows. So
is that a lot? I don't have a frame of reference, right?
Yeah, so I was going to say, you know, you can probably take 10 virus particles or less to infect a mouse in an experimental study. And so, you know, that's a lot of doses to infect a lot of different animals. If you're a flu virus, an H5N1 flu virus, it seems that the udder of a cow is a great place to be.
I think this is where maybe Richard and I disagree just a little bit, because I agree with Richard when he said in 2023, absolutely, then the risk was really low, right? Because we're not around birds a lot. We're not around seals. But with cows, the interface with humans is really high. There's a lot of interactions. And as Richard just said, there is so much virus. I mean, I think as virologists, we are shocked at the amount of infectious virus, like 100 million particles per little milliliter of milk. And they're milked 2 to 3 times a day. And every cow in a dairy parlor, for most dairy parlors, I'm not saying everyone, their teats are cleaned by hand by a person. And then their teats are forestripped, which means, like, you know, squeezing them to initiate the letdown. And so these individuals are exposed to a lot of potential virus in this milk, as well as in people in processing facilities. So to me, I agree. Like, I think this is why we've seen so many more infections in 2024 than we saw in 2023. And a serosurvey from the CDC said that, you know, 7% of dairy farm workers were seropositive for H5 antibodies. And so I do think we're missing a lot of infections. And the reason I think that's important is because every time this virus gets into a human, it has the potential to gain properties like Richard described about the receptor binding, but also other ones that we know are important for transmission, or we think are important for transmission, or properties that we don't even know are important for transmission, but are important. And that means it has the potential to continue to spread in humans.
Seema, you know, I think a lot, like I said in the intro, I think a lot of people are thinking about this in terms of COVID, our, you know, our most recent pandemic experience. And I guess, what will a March 2020 look like for bird flu? Like, how will we know we're there? And is that even the right question to be asking?
You mean like when we all went into lockdown in March of 2020?
I mean, yeah, like when we knew that this was a disaster, when like we widely knew this was a bad situation.
I think it's definitely going to have a lot more human infections, of course. That's probably going to be when we have maybe a March 2020-like situation. I think what I have been trying to focus on since I heard about this outbreak is to get us to where we're not at a March 2020 situation. You know what I'm saying?
Thank like, you. Have, yes.
Yeah. I have young kids. I don't want to be in a lockdown again. Like, no, nobody does. Nobody wants this virus to succeed in humans. Absolutely not. And so one thing that I have been surprised by is that we haven't taken stronger steps to control the virus in the source.
What should we be doing? Walk us through it.
In my opinion, some of the things we should be doing, one is a stay-at-farm order. You know, cows are transported so much in this country, more than I ever imagined. And they are transported across farms within a state. They're transported across state lines. So we are getting a lot of spread of this virus because cows are being transported that are not known to be infected. So one, number one, is a stay-at-farm order. Because if we can do a stay-at-farm order, maybe we can then go in and assess the extent of this outbreak across every state in the U.S., across every herd. And so that we actually understand how big is this outbreak in cows.
Like, we don't even know that at the moment.
Well, we don't even know that. No, we don't even know that.
When we say 900 herds, that's not actually a meaningful number.
That's only 900 herds in the states that are testing.
Okay.
Talk about COVID flashbacks, like testing. There is not universal testing of bulk milk tanks. Let's not even talk about individual cows at the moment, of bulk milk tanks across the U.S. That's not happening. And then once a herd is positive, there is no information of which cows or how many cows on that herd are positive. And so let's say the initial outbreak is 10% of the herd. And 90% of that herd is not infected. We are then just letting that virus spread to all of these susceptible, potentially susceptible cows.
Right. There are interventions we could be taking, is
there
what I mean.
There are interventions we could be taking. So, of course, like, you know, PPE is also important. I have been to a number of dairy farms, and I will be honest, I see a lot of farm workers wearing gloves, but not a lot wearing eye protection or respiratory protection. And so that is a concern, of course. So PPE could be enhanced and requirements around that could be enhanced. And vaccination, you know, this is really Richard's wheelhouse. You know, this is what he does. And there are stockpiled H5 vaccines.
Yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense to be at least offering the H5 vaccine we do have to these workers. Yeah, of course, offering it and actually getting into people's arms are two different things. I think there's a good experience from Finland where they actually did this. So they tried to vaccinate workers involved in the fur industry over there. They got an abysmal uptake of vaccine in those workers. So I think it's a good idea to offer it, but you know, there's going to be have to be a lot of outreach. It's got to have to be people who have the trust of the individuals working on these farms that say, hey, vaccination's a good thing. It's going to protect you. It's potentially going to protect your family. But so, yeah, it's not something we can say, let's vaccinate and we're going to get 90% of these people vaccinated tomorrow. But I think it's something we absolutely should be thinking about.
Is there anything individuals should be doing? Should I get rid of my bird feeder? You know, is there something that I should do to keep myself safe?
So again, from my perspective, I think you're probably fine with a bird feeder in the backyard, but you've got to try hard to catch. I think that's, probably still the case. So from a bird feeder in the backyard, the risk, you're raising your risk minimally. But again, we've got to think this virus is widespread. It's widespread in wild animals. It potentially, if your cat goes in and out, that cat could interact with wild birds. So I think people have got to be aware of the fact that the virus is out there. If you see something that looks sick, doesn't look right, certainly if it's not your own cat, take a wide berth. If it is your own cat, just think about that as well. Perhaps wear a little, put gloves, wash your hands type things, talk to your vet. I say the cat, but there's lots of other animals as well.
Be careful with your sea lion. Yeah.
If you've got a sea lion out in your backyard, yes, absolutely. Just take note if it starts to sneeze.
Seema, any last thoughts?
Yeah, I'd add to Richard's caution. Also, don't drink raw milk. Don't eat raw cheeses. It's not something that normally should be advised anyways, but really now it could be a way to have increased exposure to H5 and infection potential. And don't handle any dead animals or sick animals that you see lying around.
People have been studying these H5 viruses since they really first emerged in 1997. And this batch of viruses that's circulating globally and, in our own backyard now, probably are the nastiest virus that we've seen in terms of ability to cause disease, either in laboratory model systems or you think of the mass die-offs we've seen in the sea mammals. The number of birds that have fallen out of the sky. So yes, hard to catch, but it's a virus that has a scary ability to cause severe disease. So, I can't say 10 people drinking more raw milk, they're all going to get sick, but having seen what this virus can do, I surely won't be drinking any.
That was very informative. Thank you both for joining me.
Yeah, thanks, Laura.
Thank you so much for having us.
Dr. Seema Lakdawala is co-director for the Center for Transmission of Airborne Pathogens and associate professor studying influenza viruses at Emory University in Atlanta. Dr. Richard Webby is the director of the WHO Collaborating Center for Studies on the Ecology of Influenza in Animals and Birds, and a virologist at St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee. After the break, what would artificial general intelligence look like in the real world? We'll be right back. This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The tech world is in a race to create artificial general intelligence called AGI, and it's been promising AGI's arrival for years. Now, if you're not familiar with AGI, that's what we're going to do. We're going to try to get you in the loop. Let's start. OpenAI is an organization founded in 2015. It makes the chatbot ChatGPT. It has also said that its founding goal was to build AGI. That is a system that, according to the founders, quote, benefits all of humanity and gives everyone incredible new capabilities. Others in the field, like DeepMind co-founder Demis Hassabis, have called AGI, quote, a system that should be able to do pretty much any cognitive task that humans can do. On the other hand, OpenAI CEO Sam Altman said AGI would, quote, matter much less than people think. So which is it? Will AGI elevate all of humanity, or will it end up not mattering that much? And just what is artificial general intelligence supposed to mean anyhow? A lot to unpack here. Who better to answer these questions than someone who researches the intersection of machine and human intelligence? That would be Dr. Melanie Mitchell, professor of complexity at the Santa Fe Institute, where she researches cognition in artificial intelligence and machine systems. Welcome back to Science Friday. Been a while.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Nice to have you back. All right. Now that we've been rattling off all these definitions of AGI, What is your definition of AGI, and if you think it is really definable?
Well, honestly, I'm not one to give a definition of AGI because I'm not fond of the term, I have to say, because it is so ill-defined, and it makes the assumption that humans have something like general intelligence, which I think is not really true. Humans have very specific kinds of intelligence that are good for the kinds of environments that we find ourselves in, but not for everything. But AGI has been defined in so many different ways, it's almost lost any rigorous meaning.
Really? So how is AGI then different than, let's say, ChatGPT or Perplexity or any of those services you use and ask it for a prompt or a question?
Well, it depends on how you define it, of course. Originally, AGI was defined as some system that goes beyond doing a narrow kind of task or capability. So if you think back to, say, Deep Blue, which played chess, or AlphaGo, which played Go, they were superhuman in their abilities to play those games, but they couldn't do anything else. So they were what people called the kind of narrow AI. General AI was supposed to be machines that are more like humans, that have the range of human intelligence, and that are more, you might say, like the AI that we see in movies that can do all kinds of things. So ChatGPT is more general than, say, AlphaGo or Deep Blue, but it certainly can't do the range of things that humans can do. So I think that when OpenAI says its goal is to produce AGI, what they mean in some sense is to get machines that can do really all of the kinds of things humans can do, but then they put a caveat on it. You mentioned it at the beginning when you said cognitive tasks. So they want to separate the idea of being able to do all the so-called cognitive things that we do from the physical things that we do. You know, ChatGPT is not going to go fix your plumbing or re-roof your house.
Right.
So they don't count those interactions with the physical world in their definition of AGI.
And lately, some people like Sam Altman have started throwing around the word superintelligence more often in these conversations. Not to open another can of worms here, but how is that different from artificial general intelligence?
Good question. So I think, you know, we have this notion of human level AI, which is sort of the equivalent to AGI, aside from all those physical things that I mentioned.
Right.
But super intelligence is AI that's better than humans across the board. You know, we already have AI systems that are much better than humans at many different tasks. We've had that for a long time, including playing chess or perhaps other, you know, navigating a city very quickly with maps and so on. But super intelligence in this context, kind that Sam Altman's looking for, is AI systems that are better than humans at everything.
Is this like Ray Kurzweil's singularity moment? You know, when AI surpasses human intelligence and we become the robots?
Yeah, in some sense, that's right. So Kurzweil's singularity is the moment that AI systems become smarter than humans. And in that, his view, they're going to be able then to improve themselves. And so you get this kind of feedback loop, positive feedback loop, where they're getting smarter and smarter and smarter. And then we have this singularity that where machine intelligence sort of becomes, in some sense, incomprehensible to humans. That's Kurzweil's vision.
Yeah, so that's not the super intelligence Sam Altman is talking about, or is it?
I think it is, you know. And Sam Altman has this idea that once we get super intelligence, we'll get super, super intelligence, and then super, super, super intelligence. And then we'll, you know, have machines that have cured cancer and figured out how to colonize Mars and all of these things.
Right. Let's start talking about this word intelligence. And this is a big question. How do you study intelligence? What do people who do this work think about the concept of intelligence itself?
Right. So intelligence is a kind of an umbrella term for a lot of different kinds of capabilities. And, you know, we think of our abilities to reason, to figure out what's causing what in the world, to figure out how to interact with other people and understand them better. You know, I don't think intelligence is any one thing. It's a whole host of capabilities. And some people have strengths in some areas of intelligence and others have other kinds of strengths.
Right.
Some animals are more intelligent in some areas than even humans, but humans have this capability for reasoning and for reasoning about our own reasoning and kind of being able to understand the world in a deeper way than perhaps any other species.
Does that include self-awareness?
I think it does. I think self-awareness is a key part of intelligence because it helps us understand and reason about our own thinking. And I think self-awareness is something that current machines lack.
Right.
ChatGPT doesn't have self-awareness. It doesn't have the concept of itself as an entity, I believe. And that's part of what's keeping it from being more intelligent. You know, it doesn't have any sense of whether what it's saying is true or false, or whether it has more confidence versus less confidence in some of its statements. And from that, we see that it, you know, it can produce untrue things that are it's just as confident about as the true things that it generates.
Well, you know, people who claim to be intelligent also can produce untrue things.
Absolutely.
That they know to be untrue.
Right. And that's when you say they know to be untrue, that's a kind of self-awareness. That's an intention. Right. Whereas these systems like ChatGPT don't have these kinds of intentions. You know, they don't have the intention to be deceptive or to be truthful. They're really just generating text according to some probabilities that they've calculated about what's the sort of most likely kinds of things that they should be saying.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the history a bit behind this term AGI. But also AI itself. I know you've been studying this for a while. How far does it go back?
So the term AI goes back to the 1950s when a group of people had a meeting at Dartmouth College about this new field, and they had a kind of arguments about what to call it. And one of the founders of the field, John McCarthy, suggested artificial intelligence as a way to distinguish the field from other kinds of fields that were studying intelligence at the time. He later regretted calling it artificial intelligence because, you know, why are we calling it artificial? We should be seeking actual, real intelligence.
Yeah, makes sense. Yeah.
But other people proposed other terms for this field. One of them was Herbert Simon, who suggested complex information processing, which avoided the sort of anthropomorphism of intelligence, the notion of intelligence. So you can imagine maybe the way that we think about these systems might have been a little different if we didn't call them artificial intelligence.
Right. And you've written how Star Trek has had a kind of outsized influence on the direction of the field as a whole.
Yeah, exactly. You know, as I said in the book I wrote on AI, that there's a probably a pretty good correlation between the people who are drawn to study AI and the people who like Star Trek. And one of the elements in the early Star Trek episodes was a computer. It was just called computer that would answer any question. You know, you could ask it anything and it would give you a very cogent, concise, correct answer. It knew everything. And this computer was really what a lot of people in AI said that they felt it was sort of their North Star for building AI systems. They wanted an AI system that was like the computer in Star Trek.
But we're close to that. I mean, on a superficial level, aren't we? You can ask ChatGPT and speak to it and get an answer.
Yeah. So we are closer than we've ever been, for sure. But ChatGPT and these other generative AI systems lack something that that computer had, which is trustworthiness. Oh. You know, often you could trust anything the Star Trek computer told you. But with ChatGPT, while most of the things that it tells you are correct, it does have a tendency to do what people have called hallucinate, which is to generate very confident sounding answers that actually are untrue. So this is, I think, the next frontier, if you right. will, is the final frontier is trustworthiness with these kinds of machines.
Do we need another breakthrough somewhere down the line to get this to be more of self-aware? I guess it's the intelligence that we can't define. You can't really define AGI right now. So that, you know, it's the old phrase, I don't know exactly what it is, but I'll know it when I see it.
Yeah, I think we need a couple breakthroughs. One, it would be in how to make these systems more trustworthy, more self-aware, more have a better notion of what they're talking about and whether it's true or false. We also need to better understand what we mean by intelligence. As you know, you said, we know it when we see it. But one of the problems is that we've thought that for maybe millennia, and it turns out we've often been wrong. So just as an example, people used to think before the age of Deep Blue, the chess-playing computer, that in order to play chess at a grandmaster level or a superhuman level, you'd have to have superhuman general intelligence. But it turned out that you could get a computer to play chess at this superhuman level without anything like we'd call general intelligence. The same thing has been said of things like speech recognition and conversation, like the kind that we have now with ChatGPT, that to get those kinds of abilities, you'd need something like general human intelligence, human level intelligence. But it's turned out that we can accomplish these kinds of capabilities without having this idea of general intelligence, the kind yeah. that the pioneers of AI really were looking for. Yeah. So it's really taught us a lot about how hard it is to define what we mean by intelligence and to know when we have a system that's close to having that.
Well, with that caveat in mind, especially about how wrong we always are in predicting the future, I want you to predict the future for me. Here it is, beginning of 2025. What should we be paying attention to this year? What kind of developments are you expecting to hear about in AGI or from any of these companies?
Well, I think, you know, one thing is that, you know, this word AGI has gotten so much cachet that people will be trying to sort of redefine it into existence to say, well, what we have at the end of 2025 is clearly AGI because, and then have some definition that captures what we have. So I do think that that is likely to happen. But I also think that people are going to realize that these systems are actually lacking a lot of the very important aspects of what makes human intelligence more sort of trustworthy when it is and more general, and that those things people are going to start focusing much more effort on in their development of AI systems.
Yeah, because people in general are afraid. They're fearful of computers from what they see in science fiction and what they're watching in their real life. Now you have to become more trustworthy.
Absolutely. You know, there's the fear that the machines will get too intelligent and will, you know, take over. But there's also the opposite fear that the machines won't be intelligent enough to do the things we give them to do, but we'll trust them too much and they will fail in ways that we didn't expect. So I think both of those fears might be worth considering.
Yeah, I can see that in both in good and bad, like in medicine and even in computer warfare, if you trust your machines, right?
Yeah, we don't want to trust them too much when they haven't, in some sense, earned our trust.
Well, you have earned our trust, Dr. Mitchell. I want to thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Well, thanks very much. this is a very important topic, and I'm thrilled to be able to talk about it with your audience.
Well, you're welcome. We're happy to have you. Dr. Melanie Mitchell, Professor of Complexity at the Santa Fe Institute in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And one more thing before we go, saying hello to WNYC listeners in New York joining us in this hour. Thank you for being here, and also wishing a very warm sci-fi welcome to folks listening to us on WFYI in Indianapolis. Glad to have you along for the ride as our 500th station. Yes. And that's about it for this hour. If you missed any part of the program or you would like to hear it again, yeah, subscribe to our podcasts. Or how about trying our newsletters, sciencefriday.com/newsletters, or reach out to us the old-fashioned way. Our address is scifry@sciencefriday.com.
I'm Flora Lichtman.
And I'm Ira Flatow. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week.